This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
All right, what do we got first? We got Beard coming up first. All right, do we have Stephen on the line?
Yeah, I'm here, Kai.
All right, Stephen, back to you in a second.
Okay,
good. Numbers are what today? Mixed? I got more water? Yeah. Okay, all right, good. Oh, you guys!
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Nothing like a deadline to concentrate the mind, right? We just blew ours. The Greeks have blown theirs who knows how many times. And they did it again today in the debt deal that is never going to die. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 6th of February. Good to have you with us. German Chancellor Angela Merkel went to Paris today. It was, yes, another meeting on European debt. Time is of the essence, she said. Which struck us as kind of funny, to be honest, because how many times have we been told that this time Europe really means it, that a deadline for an agreement on Greek debt was do or die? A lot of times, right? Today's version goes something like this. In order to get its next slice of bailout money, about $170 billion plus or minus, Greece was supposed to deliver a cost-cutting plan to the IMF and the European Union today. Today was the deadline. Or was it? Marketplace's Stephen Beard is in London with us. He's got the story from there. Hey, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
So was today actually the deadline, my friend?
Well, I'm not sure what the Greek word for deadline is, Kai, but it seems to be a much more elastic concept than we're used to. The first deadline actually was a week ago. Then it was extended to last weekend. Then it was noon today. Now it's tomorrow. In fact, now they're arguing about whether there is a deadline after all.
What is the actual deadline about? The Greeks have to do what to get what?
Well, the Greeks have to agree. I mean, there are two parts to this agreement. There's an agreement between Greece and its private sector creditors. Those talks seem to be going okay. But the main stumbling block are the talks between the Greek government and the IMF and the EU over the second bailout. This is where the problems are. And the main problem seems to be Greece's three main political parties. They're haggling over the details. The IMF and the EU are reportedly asking for a lot more austerity. But these political parties who face an election as early as April don't want to sign up to anything as unpopular as austerity.
Yeah. I don't know if you caught the show on Friday from Vegas, but I said to Heidi Moore in the wrap, I said, you know what, I'm not going to talk about Greece anymore until the 20th of March, because that, she told me, is the real drop-dead actual deadline. So first of all, I've broken my promise, and I apologize for that. But second of all, is that really now where we are, 20th of March?
Well, actually, the real deadline, and the deadline after which Greece will be dead, or rather will slide into a messy default, is March the 27th, because they have 7 days of grace. That's 7 days after some $18 billion worth of debt falls due. If Greece hasn't got its bailout by then, it will default. But the European Commission says the Greeks can't leave it until the last minute. They can't leave it until March the 26th, because there are legal procedures. There's legislation that has to be passed. The European Commission says February the 16th is
for
the deadline.
All right, stop right there. You yourself have a deadline, though. You're supposed to be in Athens tomorrow for us, right?
That's
yet,
right.
You're not going to make it?
I have to be on the ground reporting tomorrow. The Greek unions have called a general strike. It may be impossible to fly into Greece tomorrow. Actually, it may be impossible to fly out of Britain. We've had a cold snap here, which cut the number of flights out of Heathrow by half yesterday. So who knows? My deadline may be looking like a Greek deadline this time tomorrow.
Stephen Beard in London. Thank you, Stephen.
Okay, Kai.
On Wall Street today, yeah, they know a little something about deadlines there. The markets close when the markets close. It was a bad start, break-even finish. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Goldman Sachs CEO Lloyd Blankfein runs the most powerful bank on Wall Street, if not on the planet. You've seen him grilled at congressional hearings over deals that Goldman did during the financial crisis. He's been sharply criticized for claiming Goldman does God's work. So he has kept himself largely out of the headlines lately. But he's back in the news today in an unusual role for a Wall Street CEO. Blankfein is the first national corporate spokesman for a high-profile issue being championed by the Human Rights Campaign. Our New York bureau chief Heidi Moore has the story.
You wouldn't normally connect Goldman Sachs executive Lloyd Blankfein with gay marriage.
I mean, I was astonished to see Lloyd Blankfein come out for gay marriage because I could say to myself, what the hell does he care about gay marriage?
That was Michael M. Thomas, a former Lehman Brothers partner. He said it's almost unheard of for Wall Street executives to take a public stance on divisive social issues. Fred Saints of the Human Rights Campaign agrees. He was the one who asked Blankfein to do the ad. He wanted to break the ice with the finance industry, which is perceived to be conservative.
After you have Lloyd Blankfein's name behind an effort, we believe and hope that it will be increasingly easier to get the names of other CEOs added to this important list.
Saints says Blankfein led a push last year to win the business community's support for gay marriage in Goldman's home state, New York. But while Blankfein's public stance is rare, few on Wall Street think it will be controversial. In large corporations and banks, the world Goldman does business in, diversity is a common goal. Companies from Microsoft to Macy's to Home Depot have supported gay marriage. Thomas, the former Lehman partner, says that supporting gay marriage won't lose Blankfein any deals.
As a frank matter, the kind of people who are opposed to this haven't got the wherewithal to do business with Goldman Sachs anyway.
In other words, Blankfein doesn't have to worry about how things might play in Peoria. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
An interesting thing happened over the weekend as Facebook users absorbed the news of Facebook's looming initial public offering. There were more grumblings online than usual that Mark Zuckerberg and company are getting rich off users' content. David Streitfeld is a technology writer for the New York Times. David, good to have you with us.
Thanks for letting me be here.
It's kind of interesting that people are just now sort of focusing on this idea that they are the content that Facebook's making all this money off of.
I think it really occurred to them when they saw the news stories last week that said Facebook was a $75 billion company. It really hit home to them.
That sort of implies that you believe this is going to be a bad thing or that there's the potential for this to go south for Facebook?
I think it's a public relations problem for Facebook. They'll have to deal with it in the next few months before their shares start trading. I don't think it's gone far enough yet to become a real business backlash and where people will start dropping out of the site, but it might. It easily could get there.
Here's the thing, though. I mean, Google has been making money off of our searches for years and years and years now. Is Facebook different because it's who our friends are and what our pictures are and you know, what I had for lunch the other day and who I saw?
With Google, it was making money off your searches, which were a little distant from you. With Facebook, all you're doing is posting a photo of, you know, your adorable two-year-old, and Facebook transmits that into data that it uses to sell you an ad. Most people don't really want to have the sense that their adorable two-year-old is a way for someone else to make money.
Seems to me we probably ought to get over that, huh?
Should we get over it? I don't know. There is a small but growing sense that people should control the information about themselves and decide if they want it to be sold.
Well, just as by way of closing, where do you think this goes? Does anything change with the way Facebook uses our data?
I think Facebook will increasingly interface, discuss with its users how it's going to make changes and give people some sense that they're participating in the process, that it's not being dictated to them by rich people in Silicon Valley.
David Streitfeld, a technology reporter from the New York Times. We got him up in Silicon Valley. David, thanks a lot.
Thanks for letting me be here.
Here's kind of an amazing number from a study they did in New York not too long ago. More than 140,000 elderly people have had serious money or other real assets taken from them without their permission. That's in New York State alone. And in all too many cases, it's not a con man, but a family member who's to blame for a kind of elder abuse that goes seriously underreported. Here's Marketplace's David Brancaccio.
Liz Lowy is ruthless when it comes to rooting out elder abuse, be it physical or financial. She has, for starters, no tolerance for jerks who can't wait for the inheritance.
Is it really a crime? And the answer is that parent dead yet? If the answer is no, then it's still a crime.
Lowy's a prosecutor in Manhattan. This afternoon, she's at a podium.
Can you guys hear me?
She's addressing the Meals on Wheels folks who deliver food to the elderly in New York.
Elder abuse is the hidden crime.
She wants them to be on the lookout for fishy stuff.
Red flag.
Like lots of ATM withdrawal slips when the cardholder doesn't get out much. Lowy lists a single day's worth of suspicious withdrawals, $460, $360, then $200.
All on the 15th.
Then the next day.
$200, $200, $400. Red flag.
She has stories about some other crazy red flags she's seen. Victoria's Secret lingerie bills for size 16 when the elderly person weighs 80 pounds.
Call it in. We can look into it. Thank you very much for listening.
But it gets more confounding.
I'm here to tell you that many of our cases involve kids or grandkids or other relatives.
We all run into them. The relative who makes a fuss about their sacrifices for old mom, who then uses mom's checkbook without asking. Experts also say keep an eye on the ones who go around with 50,000-watt senses of entitlement. Or listen to this real gem of a sister.
One elderly victim who went into the hospital with kidney failure and asked her younger sister to just pay her rent when she was in the hospital.
She signed a power of attorney, a document turning control of her finances over to the sister.
P.S., the elderly victim got out of the hospital and her personal belongings were out of her apartment. And basically, all of her funds had been depleted by her younger sister, who gambled the money away at a casino in Atlantic City.
For each case of major financial abuse that comes in, 43 go unreported, according to a big survey in New York State. Who wants to call the cops on their own kids? Plus, many victims feel trapped, as in so many spousal abuse cases. Dr. Mark Lax, head of geriatrics at New York Presbyterian, is author of Treat Me, Not My Age, and worked on that elder abuse study.
The stereotype of the older person being dependent on the child for financial resources, it's exactly the opposite. The data shows us that, in fact, it's the kind of failure to launch adult child who is the most common perpetrator.
In the spring, Lax shared his research results with lawmakers in Washington, also testifying a legendary actor.
I had the honor of being upstaged by Mickey Rooney at a Senate hearing before the Aging Committee. Mickey Rooney, the recent victim of financial exploitation by stepchildren, got up there, and the place was riveted.
My money was taken, misused. What finances I had. When I asked for information, I was told it was none of my business.
Mickey Rooney, now 91, is suing a stepson whose lawyers have repeatedly denied their client ever acted improperly. Lax says in his practice he sees elder financial abuse down through the income levels.
For the middle class, someone with a $200,000 nest egg, once that is in fact absconded with, you're done. And we all pay for that, David. When one becomes impoverished, one becomes a Medicaid recipient, a ward of the state.
Given these costs for all of us, what's being done? While some states make it a crime not to report signs of elder abuse, few get punished, and Lax says those laws need teeth. Liz Lowy, the prosecutor, is big on telephone hotlines to gather elder abuse tips. In Washington, a federal effort to crack down on elder abuse was made law back in 2010, but is stuck in limbo. For 2 years now, Congress has denied the funding to put this Elder Justice Act into action. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
Coming up, deforestation that makes both financial and environmental sense.
Our whole desire is to produce something that the consumer can trust, hands down. It's going to come a time when we have enough volume that we can supply McDonald's for all of Latin America.
Brand Amazon, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's down 17 points today, about a 10%, closed at 12,845. The blue chips did. The NASDAQ off 3 points, also around a 10% to 2901. The S&P 500, it was down a half a point, we'll call that flat, finished at 1344. Investors quarantined health insurer Humana today, driving shares down by more than 5%. The company hit earnings expectations but pulled back its full-year forecast. Boeing coasted down more than 1% on news that the tail sections on some of its new Dreamliners, the 787s, need repair. Elsewhere, J.P. Morgan Chase lost a third of 1%. Investors frowned on the bank's agreement to pay more than $100 million to settle litigation that it charged excessive overdraft fees. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.9%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve is scheduled to release consumer credit data for December. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke joins the Senate Budget Committee to talk about the outlook for U.S. monetary and fiscal policy. And imagine the president looking over your homework. Yep, President Obama will view exhibits of student work at the White House Science Fair. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
So look, I know what happens in Vegas is supposed to stay in Vegas, but it's a little tricky when you put it on the radio. We took the show to Nevada Friday ahead of the caucuses there, looking at the economy and politics. Listener Lois Barleon from Chicago had this to say about our coverage on a day when the unemployment report was actually pretty good. Leave it to Marketplace, she wrote, to rain on the economy when the numbers get better. Let's turn to Nevada and go to depressed real estate areas to see just how bad we can make people feel on a Friday night so they don't do anything to contribute to the economy over the weekend except, perhaps, gamble and drink. In a commentary Wednesday, Amity Schles criticized the way President Obama's treating American businesses.
President Obama plans to build much of his election year policy agenda around carrots and sticks. In Obama's world, businesses and business people are the rabbits in need of behavioral change.
Josh Bolick from Tallahassee, Florida, was just one of many who wrote to point out that she got the reference wrong.
The carrot and stick idiom doesn't refer to rabbits at all, but to donkeys or mules, who are well known for their intransigence. Perhaps a mule might bear more resemblance to our economy anyway.
Finally, what Google can teach us. I talked to behavioral economist Sendhil Malinathan last Friday, in part about how Google's autocomplete function can tell you a little bit about what people think. That had Julia Brodsky and her sons Laurel and Andrew in Boulder, Colorado, trying out a few searches of their own.
For example, why is my house haunted? Why is my sister such a jerk? Why are Californians moving to Austin? Why are Americans so fast? My kids guessed this one before we even started typing.
As always, let us know what you think. Email works best. Go to marketplace.org and click on that link that says contact. Depending on the menu at the Super Bowl party you went to yesterday, there might be some chili con carne for leftovers today. Commentator Mark Bittman says maybe, but probably not as much as you might think.
America eats more meat than any other country in the world, about 1/6 of all meat consumed, though we're less than 1/20 of the world's population. But that's changing. You might even say the numbers are plummeting. The Department of Agriculture says that our meat and poultry consumption will be about 12% less in 2012 than it was in 2007. Beef consumption has been in decline for about 20 years. Chicken is way down in the last 5, and pork has also been slipping. You might say, holy cow, what's up? The industry blames a familiar quartet: drought, recession, exports, especially to China, and ethanol, which is causing an increase in the price of feed. And although it's all true, meat is more expensive, and much more is being exported. There's a factor that the industry doesn't like to talk about. That factor is a conscious decision on the part of many of us to simply cut back. Availability may be down, but it's not as if we're going to the supermarket and finding empty meat cases or deli counters filled only with coleslaw. And even if people are buying less meat because prices are high, that's still a choice. We could cut back on junk food, or shirts, or iPhones. Some people are eating less meat for the right reason. It's called flexitarianism, where people eat mostly vegetables, but will also indulge in meat. It's an idea that may not have set the world on fire, but it's clearly a trend. One recent survey of home cooks found that a third said they ate less meat last year. Another found that half of Americans were aware of the movement toward Meatless Mondays, and more than a quarter of those were actively reducing their meat consumption. Ask anyone you know. Most of them are eating less meat or trying to. And ask this, is anyone in this country eating more meat than they used to? A 12% reduction in just 5 years is significant. And if that decline were to continue for the next 5 years, well, few of us would have imagined that. This is something only meat producers could get upset about. The rest of us should be celebrating.
Mark Bittman is a columnist for the New York Times. His most recent book is called How to Cook Everything. We talk a whole lot about sustainability around here, but for a lot of people, their understanding of just how ecological changes and the health of Mother Earth are connected started with Brazil and the Amazon rainforest and deforestation, cutting down huge numbers of trees every year for logging and farming. But here's something a lot of people might not know. A couple of years ago, the Brazilian government decided to fight back. It promised to reduce deforestation by 80% by the end of this decade. Justin Rowlett, the host of the BBC program Business Daily, our partners in a joint production a couple of months ago, is just back from the Amazon. Justin, good to talk to you again.
Yeah, very good to talk to you, Kai.
Tell me about deforestation, which is the purpose of this trip and the reporting you did. What's the government doing down there about this?
Certainly in the Amazon, we've all seen those incredible images of burning forests, of trees being cut down. But actually, the government is making a real effort to reduce deforestation and has turned things around in an incredible way. So in the last 6 years, the rate of deforestation has dropped by 70%. So last year, 2,300 square miles of rainforest was cut down. Now, of course, that does sound like a lot. That is a lot. But it's the lowest level since records began.
How are they doing it? Are they getting out there and just patrolling more?
They're getting out and patrolling. That IBAMA, that's IBAMA, not Obama. IBAMA is the Brazilian Environment Agency. Well, what they're doing, they've become much more focused. They're using absolutely state-of-the-art satellite monitoring to work out where deforestation is taking place. And when the data comes through on the satellite monitoring, they go out and they try and get the bad guys. And I was out there with them.
We've just landed the helicopter and the officers are going over to the truck here, which clearly has been, got freshly cut logs on it.
Justin, what do the loggers say when you catch them? I mean, do they offer a defense at all?
You know, I mean, I think everyone in Brazil knows that cutting trees down isn't kind of good for the environment. Yeah. So the environment agents captured about five loggers, and we spoke to one guy who was pretty frank about what he felt about logging.
Yeah, no, it's very hard, isn't it?
I know it's wrong, I've seen it on TV, but what can I do? If I don't work, I don't eat.
There are lots of people involved in this effort. One of the ones you met actually turns out to be an American, right? If I have it right, he's an ex-Special Forces guy?
Well, he's an extraordinary character. He was in a ranch that was literally, alongside, primary rainforest. And he's kind of set up an alliance of ranchers and farmers to try and stop deforestation. Now, the aim is to try and get farmers to look after the forest better. So get high standards of environmental management on the farms and then begin to market the output, the soya that's grown on those farms or the beef that's raised on those farms as kind of, if you like, Amazon-friendly product. And hopefully create a financial incentive for the farmers to look after the forest reserves on their farms better than they do at the moment. Here's what John had to say to me.
Our whole desire is it could produce something that the consumer can trust, hands down. It's going to come a time when we have enough volume that we can supply McDonald's for all of Latin America.
God, think about that. McDonald's for all of Latin America.
I mean, the output of farms in Brazil is absolutely enormous. I mean, we're talking arguably, possibly after the United States, the greatest agricultural superpower on the planet. So Brazil is already number one in beef around the world.
Let me ask you this, though. How long can this deforestation effort continue? I mean, how long are people willing to ride this out?
I mean, the economics of the forest are very clear. You know, there's a lot of money to be made cutting the forest down. You know, the trees are worth money, and then the land's worth much more money without trees on it. You know, as we've said, you know, the government's doing very well at the moment, but there needs to be constant vigilance on this. You know, the Brazilian government needs to keep its kind of effort up. So it's an ongoing battle, Kai. It's good news at the moment, but this story is by no means over.
Justin Rolette of the BBC's Business Daily, back from a trip to the Amazon basin. Justin, thanks.
Cheers, Kai. Thank you very much.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which is either a dictatorship run amok or the best thing that could have ever happened to children in Iran. Reuters is reporting today that the Institute for the Intellectual Development of Children and Young Adults in Tehran has banned dolls based on The Simpsons television show. Homer, Bart, Marge, the whole crew. Also, doll non grata, Barbie. Spider-Man and Superman, though, well, they're okay because they fight for the oppressed. That's my favorite part right there. All right, that's Marketplace from 8 p.m. on this Monday. Today, the Dow dropped 17 points, about a 10%, closed at 12,845. The NASDAQ off 3 points, also around a 10%, ended at 2901. The S&P 500 down a half a point. A fraction of 1%, 1344 the number. Our producers include Gina Delvac, Justin Ho, Millie Jefferson, and Fiona Ng. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.